The Neurodivergent Woman podcast acknowledges the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community.
We pay our respect to elders past, present and emerging and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today. Hello, this is the Neurodivergent Woman podcast.
Hi, I'm Monique Mitchelson and I'm a clinical psychologist.
And I'm Michelle Livock, and I'm a clinical neuropsychologist.
Michelle and I met at work and bonded over a shared love of feminism and yoga.
We both saw the need to provide a free resource to adult neurodivergent women. And so the Neurodivergent Woman podcast was born.
Michelle is neurotypical.
And Monique is neurodivergent.
And we bring our clinical expertise and lived experience to the topics we explore. This is a podcast where we center and showcase neurodivergent women from all walks of life.
Covering autism to ADHD and everything in between, we aim to educate and inspire women who think differently. Today on the podcast, we've got Shan Morrison. Shan is a specialist women's, men's and pelvic health physiotherapist and fellow of the Australian College of Physiotherapists. She has practiced exclusively in pelvic health for 30 years and is the director of women's and men's health physiotherapy, a private practice based in Melbourne that exists to restore pelvic health and empower every person to live their best life. Shan's clinical passion is being part of a like-minded multidisciplinary team that takes a whole person approach to supporting those experiencing persistent pelvic and sexual pain. Shan, we're so excited to have you on today to talk about this super important topic. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me, Michelle and Monique. It's great to be here.
So we might just actually jump straight into our first question, which is, what does neurodivergence mean to you? And maybe as part of that, you know, what's been your personal experience with neurodivergence?
So what neurodivergence means to me is that my nervous system is very much driven by interest and passion. So I guess for my whole life, I feel like those two words have defined me, but I actually didn't realize that that was something that was a bit special and a little bit different. And I didn't realize that that was actually one of the things that very much is a hallmark of being neurodivergent. So if something sparks joy in me, if something brings me passion, then I'm all in. And if it doesn't, then I'm pretty much all out, which can be a good and a bad thing. My journey with neurodivergence was an interesting one. My eldest son was unexpectedly diagnosed at the start of his year 12 year in 2020, so just before we went into COVID. He'd never really had any issues, but at the end of year 11 started to struggle a little bit, and a lovely psychologist suggested that maybe we should look into it, and I was like, oh, that seems interesting, because it's my beautiful daughter who had some learning challenges, and we'd seen heaps and heaps and heaps and heaps of different health professionals and had lots of assessments for her and hadn't really kind of got to the bottom of that. But in reasonably typical fashion, she had been flying under the radar. But my son getting diagnosed then, as I tend to do with things, one of my deep dives is to advocate for my children and find out how I can support them best. And so in the process of deep diving into learning about it for him, and then about 6 months later, my daughter also got an ADHD diagnosis, I started to think, wow, this is actually me too. And so I got an official diagnosis in the start of 2022, so only just over 2 years ago. And it's been a fascinating journey, really, learning a lot more about it, and then, of course, seeing it in my patients, in my work as well. But the journey's continued in that things didn't quite make sense with my lovely daughter and some of the ADHD fit, but it was another 4 years. So just last year, she now has an autism spectrum disorder diagnosis as well, which has been extremely validating for her. And I'm now on another deep dive to find out about that alongside the ADHD.
Yeah, that's amazing. We hear this story so much in adult women where They are learning about neurodivergence to support their children. Their children are going through a process of diagnosis, and then it just, yeah, unwraps a lot of layers for the parents as well. And again, unfortunately, I'm not surprised for your daughter in terms of having all these investigations and different professionals and looking at, you know, what is explaining her experience, and that not happening until, you know, a few years later because of, I think sometimes that lack of understanding and knowledge about how neurodivergence presents in girls and young women. So, which is why we're here on the podcast to talk about it and interview people. So thanks for coming on.
It's my pleasure. And, you know, you guys were quite pivotal actually in me understanding my lived experience, because I wasn't sure if I was neurodivergent when I first started reading about it, but I was really not coping as well with life. Didn't realize how much I'd really scaffolded prior to that. However, of course, had always thought I'd underachieved academically and, you know, didn't get straight into physio and found my way in back door. But during sort of 2020 to 2022, things were really hard. And I was like, oh, it's just COVID. I'm running a health business in COVID. It's a bit crazy. And I thought it was all that. And coinciding with that, I was realized too, I was perimenopausal. And I'd had no idea the impact that hormones had on the experience of being neurodivergent until I started listening to your podcast and learned so much about the interaction between hormones and the interaction between, yes, the nervous system and dopamine, et cetera. And, yeah, that really rocked my world, actually. And that's when I really started realizing it had a massive application to my work.
Yes, I would love to hear, you know, what it's like being an ADHD physiotherapist as well, because I can imagine that being a physical profession where you're working with people and the body and exercise and movement, that it may be a profession that attracts a lot of ADHDers in particular.
Yes, I think you're right. And I've started to wonder if, because I now very much identify as being neurodivergent, I'm seeing it in my colleagues and in everybody. And I'm very much trying not to do that. Yeah. But certainly I now realize that the people that I really connect with and the people that I relate to really well are, of course, also neurodivergent. I think the profession does lend itself well in that we are often a moving around profession. We do like doing things with our body and sometimes our hands. But more than the physical aspect, I actually think it's the interest in people and the passion that we have for and the empathy that we have for helping others. So I think there are a lot of neurodivergent people attracted to it for that reason as well. So from a work perspective, I very much see it as a strength, but it has had its challenges. So as the director leader of an organisation, my ability to have ideas, very different ideas, has been great, although my wonderful team do get a bit challenged by my never-ending enthusiasm for new things. And so we have a thing at work now that's called Shan's Shiny Things. And if I'm dropping lots and lots of glitter bombs on them, which I have a tendency to do, I now realize that I should be aware of the fact that I'm doing that. And we just sometimes put them aside for discussion at another time. My organizational and sort of executive function challenges have probably been the hardest thing in running a business, and some of the T's that have to be crossed and I's that have to be dotted that go along with that. And so I didn't realize what I was doing, but I've surrounded myself with a team that really complement me, that have fantastic organization, greater planning, make sure they set deadlines for me. So for a long time, I've always said to them, have to give me a deadline, otherwise it won't happen. So I have a fabulous team that appreciate what I bring, and I appreciate them. So that's been really helpful.
There's some absolute gold in there in terms of I think, really usable strategies for people who are maybe find themselves in the same position, regardless of what field you might work in. But exactly as you say, Sian, it's, I think, you know, once you get to that, you know, like you're the business owner or you're the director or you're kind of at a senior level, those challenges with executive functioning, exactly as you say, are often the things that trip up a lot of, you know, neurodivergent folk. And I love a couple of things you said there. Firstly, the term glitter bombs. I'm definitely stealing that. I think I'm going to mention that to my husband. That might be a nice reframe for some things. So I love that. I love glitter bombs. That's awesome. And what you mentioned there around the team, right? And this is part of having a diverse team. You know, need different people who have different skill sets, who do different things. And, you know, part of why one of the reasons Monique and I are so passionate about helping people understand, I guess, how their brains work and how they think about things, because the more you know what your own strengths and challenges are, the easier it is to then create a team that fleshes out the gaps, right? And then you know where you can flesh out someone else's gaps.
100%. And I love the idea of like a shiny board that you can kind of put all your like amazing ideas and tangents and glitter bombs on so you don't lose them, but then, you know, they can be brought up at a later time or a later date. I think that's fantastic. And I find working in, you know, private practice, I love working for a boss that is neurodivergent and gets it, but B has built like a team that provides that structure and that framework. So I can come into work, do what my strengths are as a clinician, leave, and then, you know, some of the executive functioning things like the billing and the appointments and the scheduling is held by that team. And so, yeah, I would encourage people to really have a think about, you know, what Sian has said and think about their own situation. And yeah, such a great strategy.
So, Sian, can you tell us a bit about your specialty in pelvic and sexual pain? So I guess what we would love for you to share a little bit about is how is pelvic and sexual pain actually defined or diagnosed? How common is it? And what are some of the causes of pelvic and sexual pain? Really broad, multiple questions there. So I'm just going to chuck the ball in your court and you can help us understand this specialty a little bit better.
Okay, sounds good. So before I specifically start talking about pelvic and sexual pain, it's probably useful to understand a little bit more broadly what a pelvic health physiotherapist might do. We've had a few changes in our sort of name or title over the years, sort of from women's health physios and to continence physios to pelvic floor physios and now to pelvic health or pelvic physios. So broadly, I work only with people who have issues that occur in the pelvis. So that would be things to do with the elimination organs, so the bladder and bowel. So for the first probably third of my career, it was essentially mostly around that. Women with bladder control problems or going to the toilet too frequently or rushing there urgently or not being able to empty effectively, issues with their bowels. So again, poor control, having to get there urgently, or things like constipation and not emptying effectively. And then also women with prolapse, women and those assigned female at birth who had one of those pelvic organs sort of moving out of place. And then as a predominantly women's health physio, I was seeing women during pregnancy and then postnatal, and realizing that the pelvic floor muscles were a big part of those conditions. And then over a little bit of time, I started to see men and those assigned male at birth and realizing that they also have pelvic health problems with their bladder, with their bowel. I mainly get referrals from medical colleagues, so GPs and specialists. So it was actually working really closely with obstetricians and gynecologists that they started wondering if we could help, this is probably about 20 years ago now, if we could help people who were experiencing pelvic pain. And then probably another decade after that, the urologist that I worked with, mostly with men who had incontinence after prostate cancer treatment, they started to wonder if we could help men with pelvic pain. And so that opened up a huge world. I'd sort of left pain a bit as a physio. So we obviously learn a lot about pain as a physio, but more focused on injuries in sport and musculoskeletal pain. And so then I really circled back to pain, but particularly pain in the pelvis. And wow, is that different? By way of definition, I suppose persistent pelvic pain would be a term that relates to there being pain in the pelvis for longer than 3 months. When there isn't a proven infection or a disease process or an identified pathology. And the official definition actually is a really interesting one because it talks about there being always associated negative emotions, negative cognitions or thoughts, behavioural and sexual consequences. And then what's really interesting is that pain is not always the only hallmark symptom. There are often a lot of other associated symptoms that go along with those organs that I mentioned before. So they affect the bladder, they affect the bowel, they affect the reproductive organs, and also the pelvic floor muscles. So it's very broad, and I had no idea how huge this area was. So we know that actually 1 in 5 women experience persistent pelvic and sexual pain. Very, very common. And that can be anywhere experienced from the early adolescent years all the way through to postmenopausal. In terms of causes, unfortunately, and you'll be not surprised to hear this, it's poorly understood and often not recognised, very, very underdiagnosed and therefore undertreated. And it's one of my missions in life to change that. So essentially what we do understand is that the pain can start in one of those organs. So it might be the uterus. And I guess probably the most common, maybe well-known pain condition would be painful periods, which can start for some women from the very first time that they have a period.
That's really interesting that you mentioned periods. Does that, this is probably a stupid question, but does that mean that technically women who experience cramping during their periods would be classified as having persistent pelvic pain? Or would that be classified as part of like premenstrual syndrome?
That's a great question. This is where some of the confusion lies. Some degree of discomfort and pain with your period is considered normal. However, if it has then lasting more than maybe the first couple of days, if it's having a significant impact on your ability to function, ability to go to school or work, and having other consequences, and then particularly if maybe that pain is continuing not when you're not menstruating or not ovulating, that would more fit then in the definition of persistent pelvic pain.
Right, gotcha. Thanks for clarifying.
Yeah, so I mean it kind of sounds like if you are having mild cramps, you know that they're there, but you can ignore. It's not causing significant distress. You're not crying, screaming, throwing up, doubled over, can't walk, can't do anything. That's more, you know, what we're talking about as that mild discomfort. Because I know, you know, to have a period for our uterus to actually shed that lining, prostaglandins are produced, which are inflammatory, but they're actually helping us get rid of that lining. So there is going to be some pain and inflammation for that normal biological process to occur, but that's mild.
Yeah. And I guess like one thing I'd add there as well, and this is, you know, often particularly relevant for neurodivergent women, is that you can actually be experiencing really severe pain, but maybe that's not evident behaviorally, right? Maybe you're just, it doesn't look like you're experiencing severe pain on the outside. And again, I'm so interested to hear your take on this, Sean, because I know just even just kind of clinically, just in psychology practice, right? A lot of women almost just feel like actually experiencing really severe and debilitating pain is normal. And so they don't do anything about it. And then they don't communicate that, right? They just feel like, oh, I just have to deal with this. So I guess just to add there, you know, the level of experience pain doesn't always have to manifest in something that's outwardly visible, like, you know, crying or whatever. But it's about how severe that pain is for you.
Yeah. And I think too, it's good to mention while we're on the topic that for neurodivergent people, particularly autistic people, if you have difficulty with interoception, you may not be able to recognize when you are in pain, even severe pain. So that can, I think, be another layer when we're talking about this as well. And then the research actually shows that, yeah, for some autistic people, they're actually much more sensitive to pain as well. So just want to acknowledge there's quite a variation of experience with this.
Yes, you both make really, really good points. And I have seen that in my clinical practice over the years prior to really understanding about neurodivergence. And then more recently, it's starting to come out a little bit in the literature, in the research. And often patients would say to me over the years of that it feels like an invisible illness, that it's something that no one else can see. But there's also, I agree, a lot of societal normalizing around period pain particularly, and that has not helped women's experience of pelvic pain in that they have felt that that's been ignored and not validated. I'd love to explore the interoception and communication aspect of how this really impacts and plays out when it comes to pelvic and sexual pain, because we've got for women and those assigned female at birth three really important organs in the pelvis, the bladder, the bowel, and then the uterus and the reproductive organs. And so the ability to be able to like listen to your body and know what it's saying to you, and then being able to communicate that to healthcare providers when it's such a sensitive and potentially stigmatizing, potentially taboo part of the body that you might not feel comfortable talking to other people about, feels very private and could be embarrassing and might make you look or feel more different than you already do, is an area that I think has been very underexplored. So there are a number of different pelvic pain conditions that may be related to any of the pelvic organs. So the bladder might be a source of that pain, or the bowel. Also other things like musculoskeletal and the pelvic floor muscles can also be a contributing factor. And then there are lots of different influencing factors like hormones, as well as lifestyle. But overall, what we understand to be what continues or maintains the persistence of that pain would be a range of biological, which can be genetic and issues in the tissues, what's happening in the nerve system, what that person's doing from a movement, sleep, nutrition perspective. In combination with the psychological factors, their beliefs, their emotions, other conditions such as anxiety and depression, and then lots of other social factors that are occurring in the world around them, such as their family, their school, work, relationships, and trauma is another big aspect of pelvic and sexual pain. And one thing that we really understand about persistent pain is the fact that it's always a sensory and emotional experience, but that it can then persist based on our brain's assessment of danger and threat. And I often reflect on that when I think about the pelvis, when I think about how important the functions that occur in the pelvis are. They're our reproductive organs and our sexual organs, and then our ability to eliminate And so the brain, quite rightly so, pays a lot of attention to that area, and pain is a protection. So often the brain, I guess, gets involved and starts to sometimes overprotect that area. And then my favorite muscle in the body, which is the pelvic floor muscles, also becomes part of that protection. So sometimes it's a responsive guarding or tension of the pelvic floor muscles that happens to protect us. And I often liken it a little bit to tension in our sort of shoulder neck muscles that can result in a headache. And it's almost like the tension and guarding and protection of the pelvic floor muscles can then result in a headache in the pelvis.
That's such a good explanation. That's so, yeah, really kind of easy to understand. Thanks for running us through that. And I guess what I'm hearing is pain is complex. I'm wondering too, and not to jump the gun here because you might have this slated to chat about later, and I'm going to mispronounce this, but is this where that condition, is it vaginismus?
Vaginismus.
Yes, thank you. I always pronounce that wrong.
Yep. That's all good.
Is that kind of part of this profile and some of the things that, you know, one of the conditions that you might come across?
Yes, absolutely. So there's a range of different conditions that can specifically lead to pain with sex. And one of them is called vaginismus, which is a little bit of a misleading term in that you might think it refers to the vagina. Ismus is spasm. The vagina spasming, but it's actually the pelvic floor muscles switching on and not wanting to let go. And that can occur in response to a range of different things. It could recur as a result of a traumatic experience, maybe an episode of painful sex. It could be a belief or a fear around something. So a lot of the people that I see who experience sexual pain then tell me, oh, I've never been able to use a tampon, or I've never been able to have a cervical screening examination. And so it's not just been they haven't wanted to have penile penetration, but it's their body hasn't been allowing them, despite their desire to do so, to have vaginal penetration of other things. And then there are some other conditions that can evolve and develop from that. So there's a range of things that can affect the vulva, like thrush or candida you would have heard of, or other conditions. And sometimes they can set up be a trigger for then sort of immune system and hormonal changes and then nervous system changes, where we'll get a sensitization of that area, which can then actually also then be driven by the entire nervous system. So an example of that would be a condition called vulvodynia, which is another condition that has painful sex as a hallmark of it. It's not only just that. It might not occur just with provocation. It might actually then be discomfort and pain in the whole vulval area with, say, wearing tight clothing or sitting or other triggers. And so you can imagine that's really impactful on people's lives if they're not able to, you know, wear what clothes they want to wear and sit as long as they want to sit, as well as then engage in intimacy and sexual relationships and whatever that looks like for them. And so sexual pain is very complicated and broad as well. And there are other known conditions that can cause pelvic pain, like endometriosis and then bladder pain syndrome or sort of interstitial cystitis, and then even things like irritable bowel syndrome and other bowel-related conditions. They can all lead to there being pain with sex as well.
Yeah, thank you so much for walking us through some of these conditions that you would commonly see in people presenting for, you know, advice. I think it's so important for us to be able to have these conversations and to, I think, break down some of the stigma about these conditions, because as you said, and I personally could not believe how common this is. 1 in 5 women experiences persistent pelvic pain, which to me is just, yeah, I'm in disbelief.
I know. And what's been heartening, I guess, is that there has been an increased awareness in the media, in political circles, and from government. So there has been some increased funding of research, been a little bit helped by some influential female politicians experiencing pelvic pain, but we still have a long way to go. And what I think is lagging behind is something that I've heard you both talk about a lot, and that is us still being quite stuck in a biomedical model. And you can apply this to neurodivergence as well as to persistent pain and persistent pelvic pain, and the influence and the two-way interaction between our physical health and then our emotional health is so significant. And there's actually different types of pain, which you would be aware of, and the new sort of term for that pain that's really influenced by the nervous system is pain system hypersensitivity. Pain system hypersensitivity makes so much sense, I think, too, when we think about its application to people who are neurodivergent and their lived experience of pain for a lot of reasons that we're trying to understand. I mean, there's definitely studies that show that neurodivergent people have increased sensory experience and increased pain experience for reasons we're trying to understand more about. I think the trauma aspect has a contributing factor in that, and the sensory challenges are definitely part of that as well. And so it's something that I would really like to see happen much more in the way that we assess and manage and support people with persistent pelvic pain is the consideration of them as a whole person in terms of their brain and their nervous system, how that interacts with their immune system, and how that interacts with their endocrine system and their hormones, and how that then interacts with any of psychological mental health challenges that they have, and of course their past experiences, and everything that's going on in their world around them with respect to stress and the influencing factors of their external world.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is where you can really see that often, you know, when we're unpacking pain, and particularly persistent pain that is lasting longer than 3 months, past maybe an initial disease and cell healing process in particular, but it really does require a multidisciplinary approach. So, you know, working with physiotherapy, working with mental health, whether that's psychology, counseling, psychiatry, working with people's GP, working with specific specialists as well. And what I tend to find is people often have multiple health things going on at once. I think addressing everything where you can in a holistic manner is really important. And we're going to talk about this quite a bit in the next question. But yeah, like if you have chronic illness as well as persistent pain, if you have a trauma history in the mix as well as mental health, and you're neurodivergent, that's going to require, you know, a lot of support. And I want to validate that. And it's going to require a lot of time and energy to unpack these individual things and to try to be taking care of yourself. Sometimes it can feel almost like a full-time job trying to manage, you know, your mental health, your neurodivergence, your persistent pain, your chronic illnesses, on top of trying to, you know, quote unquote, function in society, whether that's through work, study, raising children, being in relationships with people, maintaining friendships. You know, it's quite a lot. And I think as well, you know, just clinically speaking, when people don't know that they're neurodivergent and they've had a trauma history, they have a bunch of health conditions and persistent pain, I do actually see an improvement in the person's psychology in terms of when they understand that they are neurodivergent and they understand the link with their sensory stuff, and also they understand that they need to pace themselves even from a neurodivergent perspective so that they don't burn out. I find that having that self-understanding of their neurodivergence really facilitates, you know, almost better understanding of all the other stuff that they have going on, and it gives them that self-compassion to be able to do that self-care and to rest, and understanding that, wow, you do actually have a sensitive nervous system. And like what Sean said, the nervous system does play a big role in pain. Hi, it's Monique here. I have some exciting news. I teamed up with a fellow neurodivergent clinical psychologist called Jennifer Kemp to write a book. It's called The Neurodivergent Skills Workbook for Autism and ADHD. Cultivate Self-Compassion, Live Authentically, and Be Your Own Advocate by New Harbinger Publishers. It's out on the 1st of July this year, so spread the word. So, Sean, I've definitely noticed a pattern in, you know, I do have a very specific group of people that I work with that are neurodivergent, have multiple health conditions, experience persistent pain, have trauma in their history. But yeah, like as a physiotherapist specializing in the pelvic region and persistent pain, I'm just wondering, yeah, like, is it a more common population that you are seeing when you're working with people coming for persistent pelvic pain and sexual pain?
It absolutely is, Monique. And I was seeing this increasingly in my practice, completely as you describe, my patients experiencing a range of other different comorbid health conditions. And I felt under-resourced and under-almost educated, I guess, the more I was listening to the stories that my patients were telling me and starting to try and help them make sense of what was going on, spending time listening to them and asking them really open-ended questions around their experience and what they thought was going on, and then hearing all of these other things come out that I didn't really expect, and then realizing that they all mattered and it was all connected. And a lot of those experiences that they'd had were all influencing the nervous system, and that it was important that I took those things into consideration. And as a physio, I guess we spend a lot of time assessing the body and muscles and physical things. And I was really getting frustrated with my inability to help really make sense of everything. And I was very fortunate enough about 5 years ago to go to a conference overseas and meet an amazing Canadian physio who had really started to specifically and intentionally screen for and even measure the other aspects of things that were influencing the nervous system. And so alongside my assessment that's looking for what is going on in the body, and that isn't just muscle function, I guess I'm also looking at what is happening from a nervous system perspective to touch, like do they have pain to touch that I would not expect normally to be painful, and also to how certain movements are mapped in their brain. So does their brain have any sort of dysregulation with how they're moving their pelvis or their sensory experience of their pelvis? But alongside that, actually specifically looking at trauma and screening for trauma, then also screening specifically for depression, anxiety, stress, pain, catastrophization, positive and negative affect, fear, fear avoidance, injustice. That has so changed my practice in immeasurable positive ways, and really being able to be a lot more nuanced, I guess, about rather than just getting patients to do all of the things, it's a much more sort of intentional, integrative, trauma-sensitive approach to making sense of what's going on.
Yeah, I think that's so important. And, you know, I do think this is an area that I really would encourage not just mental health professionals to upskill in terms of understanding, you know, the impact of physical health and pain on mental health. But also, I really think it would be great to see that integration with physical health professionals. And then for both parties to also be screening for neurodivergence. So, you know, for example, if you're working in the area of persistent pain, I would be encouraging, you know, no matter what medical or allied health profession you are, your clinic, you know, your service, I would include a screening for neurodivergence because, you know, the latest research is showing quite a high amount of people who are neurodivergent experiencing different conditions that involve pain, whether it's migraines, whether it's fibromyalgia. Today we're focusing on the pelvis. But yeah, like whether you screen or not, neurodivergent clients are going to be presenting to your clinic. And if their neurodivergence is not picked up on as part of that formulation, there is an area that could be influencing their experience of their body and, you know, their nervous system, their sensory system that will then be missed.
Yes, I so agree. And initially, I think I felt a little bit, am I out of scope here? Because of my lived experience and the knowledge that I was gaining through my reading about neurodivergence, I started to see it and identify it in so many of my lovely patients. And a few people said to me, oh, that's not your place to be like, you know, raising something like that. But I decided to ignore that piece of advice. And I, in a very sensitive way and a way that wasn't me giving them a diagnosis or telling them what I thought was going on, I would often share my experience. And I have run out of fingers and toes of how many of my patients have gone on to seek a diagnosis of neurodivergence. And that has been absolutely life-changing for them. And that has been like so amazing for me to see that, as well as help them understand a lot of those other chronic health conditions, the dysautonomias. And I've got so many POTS patients in my practice, and yes, and like physios are seeing these patients all day, every day without realizing it, particularly now the link with hypermobility that we're starting to understand as well, and that link of the autonomic nervous system dysfunctions with the hypermobility with persistent pain in neurodivergence. So I just feel like it's been an amazing journey for me, and my patients are very thankful for that.
Yeah, it's a really good point, Shan, and I'm glad that you raised it, because oftentimes it is something that a lot of allied health professionals and, you know, physicians as well might have different opinions around, like who has the right to, or whose role is it to identify XYZ, right, in a client or patient that comes to see you. And I feel like this is where oftentimes there's a bit of confusion around the difference between screening and assessment. Exactly as both of you guys have said, all allied health professionals should be, or should feel competent to, screen for neurodivergence. It's part of the practice. We see so many neurodivergent clients coming in, overrepresented in the healthcare system. And so if you don't feel comfortable screening for that, and screening, you know, to be clear, it's exactly what you identified, Sean, right? Saying, hey, I'm seeing XYZ traits, you know, in you. I feel like this is probably worth, you know, if you're interested, maybe going and getting that looked at further or going through an assessment process or doing your own kind of exploration. That's exactly what all allied health professionals should be doing. So I'm really glad you raised that because I think it's a super important point. Bringing screening into your practice is not actually overstepping or stepping outside your lane of professional competency. It's exactly what you should be doing. It's identifying, hey, these flags have come up, and then I'm going to refer to someone else for more assessment if that client wants that.
Yes. And thank you for saying that, Michelle, because I was feeling a bit like that. And then I found your wonderful webinar on your website about identifying neurodiversity for allied health professionals. And that just gave me the validation and the permission to actually then say to, you know, my team, guess what? We're actually going to be even a bit more intentional about that than for it just to be a shiny thing.
Amazing. I'm so glad you enjoyed it. And if anyone else is interested, they can find that on our website. I'm Troy McClure.
It was great. And I promise that you didn't set me up or pay me to say that.
Thanks for flagging that, Sian.
But it was so helpful.
Oh, good.
I'm glad. Me, again, a bit of structure, just like it happened 5 years earlier with my lovely Canadian physio friend, Carolyn Van Dyke, and give me some structure to be able to screen for the psychosocial and trauma aspects. That gave me what I was looking for from a neurodivergence perspective.
Amazing. Yeah. And, you know, if you don't feel confident or competent in a screening process as a professional, go and do some professional development in it. It's as simple as that. You know, there is more and more becoming easily available. Yeah, just go do it.
Yes, I agree. And that's one of my core values of my practice. We've got five, but one of them is embrace learning alongside the strive for excellence. And we're just continually upskilling and you know, doing professional development. But I think what happens sometimes too is health professionals are a bit scared about potentially like opening a can of worms, or, you know, I might not be able to deal with the opening Pandora's box. I won't know what to say. And it takes a little bit of work to put, you know, some processes in place. And like when we first started including some trauma screening and assessing for distress, of course, we were then getting some expressions of distress and identifications of PTSD. But we just had developed some protocols and did some training with some external people to help us to know what to look for and what to say. We've now got a system for, you know, escalation of what do we do, what do we make sure to support people to be safe. And now we all just feel so much, we feel very supported and pleased that we can take that very, very intentional whole person approach and now adding neurodivergence into it as well.
Sian, can you run us through what are some of the ways that pelvic and sexual pain can be treated?
Sure. So I think, as I've already mentioned, the overarching approach is very person-centered, very trauma-sensitive and collaborative. And I'm very passionate about ensuring that my patient, I really want to understand their goals and I want to understand their story. And I don't want to be seen as the person that's going to fix them, because they're not broken. I see myself more as a facilitator, I guess, and sort of walking beside them to provide that support and that sort of coaching so that they can really focus on and find out what they're capable of. But often they are managing a lot of different health conditions, and so it's important that I'm aware of all of those. So one of the biggest, most important things I think from the start is education and understanding. I think knowledge is power. And there's even a lot of research now behind the concept of pain science education or pain education actually being a therapy. And I've over many, many years looked at how we can apply that to pelvic and sexual pain. So helping people really understand pain, understand how their body responds to that is really important. And actually just published March of 2024 is a nice paper that's looked at specifically applying pain science principles and education to the lived experience of those with pelvic pain. And they came up with sort of four themes of what these women would like to know that really sort of capture them. They wanted to understand that a sensitized nervous system leads to overprotective pain, and they really felt like that validated their experience. They wanted to understand that pain doesn't mean that their pelvis has always been damaged, and that really reassured them. They thought it was really important to understand how they think, feel, and see their pain could influence it, either in a positive or negative way, and that was very empowering and gave them a lot of hope. And then finally, they really wanted to understand that they could change their pain, albeit sometimes slowly, but that gave them a lot of agency. And so I work very specifically at helping people understand their pelvic pain, and particularly if I've identified catastrophization, which sounds like a bit of a judgy word, but if they're ruminating on their pain, if they're feeling very hopeless and helpless, or they're sort of magnifying it, then really trying to understand pain and how it works is helpful. And also fear is a big driver then of them not engaging in things or not wanting to exercise, which we know is so important. And so if they can understand that they're not going to cause further damage by moving, because that's one of the best things they can do, move, then that's really helpful too. So pain and science and education is huge. I guess my other big approach is finding things that calm down their nervous system. So I'm not directly treating trauma, but we can very intentionally evoke the relaxation response in the body. So I use a lot of different movement practices. So even sometimes more mindful movement practices that I would sort of call remapping, getting them to just experience novel movement and different movement. So I guess like yoga might be an example of that at times, or Qigong or other movement practices, and then other sort of visualization and general relaxation. I'll definitely spend time specifically looking at their pelvic floor muscle function and what is that muscle doing. Is it being very protective? Is it switched on and tense and guarding all the time? The pelvic floor muscle has to relax for us to urinate, for us to evacuate, as well as to be able to have insertion for a woman into the vagina. And so it's so important that they connect with their pelvic floor. And sometimes if it's been held tense and tight for their whole life, they are not aware of that, and it's really difficult to actually relax that muscle and let it go. So we use a lot of variety of approaches to help them achieve that through connection and visual feedback, approaching them in different sensory ways, looking at their breathing. Breathing's very powerful for the nervous system, but also for the pelvic floor. So using that lovely relaxed diaphragmatic belly breathing, in which incorporates the abdominal muscles as well. So I see a lot of tension in the abdominal muscles that goes alongside tension in the pelvic floor. Sometimes intentionally, but sometimes not. If you've had a lot of pain in that area, then of course those muscles are going to switch on and protect. The other thing that we'll do is a range of what I guess I would call desensitization techniques, and that's using touch. So as a physical therapist, I feel actually quite privileged that I can touch patients and I can teach them how to use touch. And rather than that being I need to touch them to fix something or stretch it, or it's too tight and I need to, you know, lay my magic hands on them, it's more about using touch to provide safety. And we will often use things like a vaginal trainer, or often prefer to use a vibrator, to help them change their brain's response to one of protection, guarding, and pain to a response of calm. And so we'll use just progressive touch. It might even just be with their fingers, and just get them to be curious and be kind and without judgment, just getting used to touch in that area and allowing the pelvic floor muscles to relax and the nervous system to relax.
Such a great point. And I think, you know, it mirrors a lot of things in our visceral experience as human beings, even when we think about things like relational safety. Someone who has never experienced safety in relationship, never felt emotionally seen or connected to, it's one thing to know intellectually, oh, yep, okay, I understand that, you know, other people are safe, but a totally other thing to actually then have that experience of the visceral experience of relational safety. And that's often what changes those patterns, not knowing intellectually, but having the experience. And I love, and it's so interesting to hear how in your work, it's kind of exactly the same thing when it comes to touch-based safety and feeling safe, having that tactile experience. Yeah, super interesting.
Yes. And I didn't really appreciate until I started to understand a lot more about arousal and the sexual response, how much fear and, well, how important safety is in so many senses of that word, and that unless someone feels free, I guess, to start with, and there's consent, and then they feel safe from their worries as well, and that they then need to be able to relax, and that could be their pelvic floor or their whole nervous system. And unless all those steps occur, then it's very difficult to become aroused and have desire. And a lot of the women I see, for example, would have had a lot of unlubricated, unaroused sort of duty sex, if you like, and understanding how important that process of and the relational safety that you mentioned, Michelle, is key to what's happening in their body and what's happening with their thoughts and their feelings. So when I do that desensitization or that work with them, it's so important that they're not just thinking about what's happening in their body, but they're also thinking about what's happening in their mind and what they're thinking, and also how they're feeling, and combining and just making that mind-body connection.
Oh, that's, yeah, just music to my ears. I love sharing information on this and talking about it, because I think it is, it's so important. And we think about things like arousal, but so often we're not taught exactly what you say, Shan, that it the opposite of that is feeling in any sense unsafe. And that could just be unsafe in your own mind or body. Maybe there's a lot of anxieties or thoughts or things going on. Maybe there's other experiences that are totally unrelated to, you know, even a sexual experience or a sexual experience with that partner. But all of those things are culminating to a point where your body doesn't feel safe to be vulnerable. Because essentially that's what, when you think about sex and connected sex and good sex, right? That's what it requires. It requires vulnerability, and not necessarily in the point of, I'm going to tell you all my secrets, but just a vulnerability at a visceral, physical level. And if you don't feel safety and you haven't had experiences of safety while putting your body in that vulnerable state, then it does. It needs that kind of retraining.
Yeah. Like I think, again, having you come on and talk about these things, Shan, is so important, because we're not really taught that the state of our nervous system relates, you know, to our sexual well-being, but also our physical well-being in terms of pain and persistent pain. And I think, you know, what you shared with that research on the psychoeducation, it's so important, you know, unless people are taught this information that, hey, actually being in fight and flight and freeze does play a role in, you know, the development of persistent pain and keeping persistent pain going. And, you know, I think a lot of the work that, you know, we can do as non-physicians, like, you know, we don't have surgery options. We don't do medication as psychologists and physiotherapies and allied health. You know, a lot of the work we can do with people is around giving them this education, helping them understand themselves, and helping them to regulate their nervous system. So they're spending more time in their nervous system in that polyvagal state of safety and connection. When we're looking at ADHD people, their mind and body is racing a million miles an hour. I know a lot of ADHDers often report feeling anxious and stressed because of that hyperactivity mentally, emotionally, and physically. And also life can be stressful if you don't have some of those resources for your executive functioning and you're juggling a lot. Then we look at autistic women and people. And when you're in sensory overload, it literally feels like your skin is going to burst. It feels like you're in a box and someone's just shaking that box and you're inside rattling around in it. And it's jarring. So how can you feel safe in your body when you're dealing with sensory overload and sensory burnout? So I think this is where that neurodivergent specific psychoeducation and that understanding can come in handy as well.
Yes, I so agree. And I can't believe that it's only been more recently how much I think pelvic health physios have come to really appreciate the autonomic nervous system and really start to think about, I mean, we learned about sympathetic and parasympathetic, of course, but really understanding the fight flight response and what happens and the impact that neurodivergence then has on that, and freeze, and actually taking a lens to my work now of really actually knowing what that looks like and having conversations with patients to help them understand the different states of their nervous system and looking at in building their window of tolerance and all the things that can help them do that, but all the things that can actually reduce their window of tolerance. And I so agree with you around the ADHD experience of not being able to everything racing. Having a Ferrari engine and bicycle brakes. Thanks, Ed Halliwell. But that is just exactly what it feels like at times, is just not being able to, and not just your body, but your mind. And the impact that that has on then your ability to relax and, well, for example, become aroused. Often chatting to my patients about, I might ask them for what their goal is, and they're just like, oh, I just want to have pain-free sex. Just want to have pain-free sex. And go, oh, would it be nice for it to be something more than just not painful? What might that look like? And, oh, I don't know. Like, well, maybe we could explore that it might be, you know, pleasurable, or what would you like it to feel like, and or enjoyable, and would you like to explore self-pleasure? And then really connecting, I guess, the safety of their nervous system. And the importance of that.
Yeah, I mean, that reminds me of a study that we've talked about before, I think maybe on our episode about sexual trauma, but there's this really incredible qualitative study that's cited in the book by Peggy Orstein, and the book's called Girls and Sex. Fabulous read, particularly if you're a parent of young girls or if you are a girl yourself. And the book is just about the, you know, experience of girls and sex. But the study that she cites is one that is basically looking at what are the factors in young boys and girls saying that they're sexually satisfied, right? What does sexual satisfaction consist of for these kind of different individuals? And whereas young boys would say things like, well, sexual satisfaction means that I had an orgasm. Yep, that makes sense. Young girls would often say sexual satisfaction means it didn't hurt and I know he had fun. Which is just a flashing neon sign that says our society communicates, you know, to everyone that sex should be about male pleasure. So, you know, there's obviously the societal stuff that feeds into that as well. And honestly, Shan, I think you're doing God's work.
Oh, thank you. Aren't you gorgeous? But it's so true. I mean, the messages out there around sex for women really, really need to change. And you won't be surprised to hear, actually, there's was a big survey done looking across all ages of women, and those, it was actually a bit surprising in terms of what was the greatest percentage age group of experiencing sexual pain. It was actually that young, the sort of teenage adolescent. You might have thought maybe it was the postmenopausal woman or that. It was actually those young women.
And now she's done with that.
That's probably true. Yeah, but yes, I know. And just that no consideration of the importance of the emotional intimacy and foreplay, and that, you know, girls don't necessarily always want it rough like on porn, and all of the things that can influence messages around sex. So I've had to definitely upskill myself in that whole area as well to really then understand. And yeah, because I guess we have the time to often talk to patients, and I very much work closely with a lot of psychologists and sex therapists and psychotherapists who do that. But it's so, the magic is when it's when we're all together with the same messaging.
Yeah, I think that's so important. And, you know, in terms of this multidisciplinary approach, particularly working with women and AFAB, I think getting all of, you know, these different things actually diagnosed the earlier on, the better. You know, I have so many women that come to me with experiences of having signs of likely endometriosis since they had their first period, and then not getting any understanding, diagnosis, support around it until like 10, 20 years later. And I think, you know, this is a bit of a call out in terms of when we're looking at persistent pain and trauma and undiagnosed neurodivergence. And we know that neurodivergent women in particular often have co-occurring health conditions. So when we're looking at all of this, it's understanding that there's a cumulative load on your nervous system. And as you move through life and different phases of life and stress, you know, if these things are not actually addressed and you don't have that understanding of yourself through the lens of neurodivergence from a younger age, these patterns get entrenched in your nervous system. You know, living in fight, flight, and freeze becomes more and more entrenched the older that you get. The patterns of movement, you know, within your body get more entrenched. The pattern of being in persistent pain and having flare-ups then gets more entrenched. And so I think, you know, I'm hopeful that things will be improving for girls, women, and AFAB in the next 10 years around getting all of this stuff sorted, diagnosed, supported earlier, because the trajectory is so much better because it's less time having these things entrenched, and it's easier to then move out of that fight and flight and, you know, move out of persistent pain or minimize flare-ups the sooner that you get onto it. That's not to say that you can't change things if it has been 10, 20, 30 years later. You know, Sean and I, like, we've worked with many people who don't get this knowledge of themselves until maybe their 30s, 40s, 50s and ongoing. But I just want to highlight the importance of having this information out there, having health professionals see these patterns, do the screenings, improving the health system. So we are not seeing women and AFAB going down this poor trajectory, particularly neurodivergent women and AFAB. I think, you know, we've been able to have a chat through a lot of information today, and I think it's fantastic to get an idea for our listeners of persistent pelvic pain and how can specialized physiotherapists assist in this area, because sometimes the unknown is frightening as well. You know, like, for example, if I got told to see a pelvic pain physiotherapist, I'd be like, what is that? Like, what do they do? I don't know anything about this. Oh, that feels a bit scary. What are they going to do to me? So I think actually really hearing you clearly explain all the different ways in which, you work with people and, you know, what does treatment look like is going to be so helpful for destigmatizing, you know, working around the pelvic floor and working around the pelvis with a physio and other professionals. So I think that's amazing. But we know that it is common for women to suffer in silence when it does come to pelvic and sexual pain. What are some of the barriers for women bringing this up with their GP or their medical team? And can you give us some advice around what's the best way for women and AFAB to broach this subject of pelvic pain and persistent pelvic pain with their GPs or medical team?
I completely agree with both of you in your insights and reflection of the challenges and the lived experience of neurodivergent women, particularly experiencing pelvic and sexual pain. I think there's the embarrassment and the fear of being dismissed because they often have been before, and feeling very alone and that maybe they're the only person who has this problem. I would encourage people to, if they are seeing an allied health professional of any sort, to speak to them about it, because I think there is increasing awareness and knowledge amongst allied health professionals in supporting them to find the language, to find the words to explain or describe what they're experiencing. And I must admit, I spend quite a bit of time with my patients often writing out questions that they're going to take to their doctor and to help them have that conversation with their GP. I think finding a supportive person in their life, whether that be a parent or a friend or a sibling or somebody, to maybe go with them to see the medical professional. I think these things you can't have a conversation about in 10 minutes or 15 minutes. And so I'm often speaking to my patients, and I know this is not always possible, but to book a long consultation. It's really tricky to go into the GP and you get yourself all ready to share lots of things and there just isn't the time to explore that. Or I guess be okay with that medical professional saying, I really want to continue this conversation with you. I really want to. Can we make another time? There are certainly medical professionals who are much more whole person focused than others. So I think use your community, like use the people that you trust that are already your trusted advisors and ask around. Like I have a lot of my patients who I think are probably just seeing the family GP that they've seen since they were very young. And it feels a bit strange for them to maybe have conversations with that person about things that are now coming up as they're growing a bit older. And so I think it's okay to change health professionals if they don't feel comfortable having that conversation with that person. It might not be about that health professional's gender, but it might just be more about how long they've known them and how safe they feel in that environment. Listening to like this podcast and really upskilling themselves and understanding that this experience is so common amongst so many other people, I hope gives them the courage to advocate for themselves. And I know that feels a bit exhausting to have to be a constant advocate for yourself and juggling multiple things. But the point you make, Monique, about this being so much better if we can identify and put in place management strategies sooner rather than later, is a really good point. And we are incredibly bioplastic. We're so, you know, we can change. And I want everyone to have hope that however long they've experienced these symptoms for, they can make a difference. And I guess because we've been talking about pelvic health physio, I now have a lot of patients who I'll see the referral and be like, oh, it's from Dr. X or Y or whatever. And I'll say, oh, that's really good. And they go, no, I told them to do that referral. I told them that I wanted to come and see you. I'd done my research, I Googled, I had a look around. I love how this next generation does really educate themselves, and it might be through TikTok or, you know, social media, but a lot of them be like, oh, well, I read on this forum, or I saw a TikTok video, and I went to the doctor and I said, I want to see a pelvic health physio. And is there someone that I can see? So they're doing that more and more, which is great. And you don't actually need a referral to see a pelvic health physio. You can actually walk off the street. I guess the things I would say that are important is we don't cover any of this in our undergraduate training. So they need to be a bit discerning around making sure that who they're seeing is actually not just got a little side interest in this, but actually has specific training and preferably postgraduate qualifications in the area. And to be able to work out if that person really knows what they're doing, unless they're taking a very holistic view of that person and really wants to know everything about them, and they're not just focusing on their pelvic floor muscles or just on their body, then I think they should find a different pelvic health physio. So don't need a referral. The one thing to talk to a GP about would potentially be there are some programs where you can get some Medicare-funded physiotherapy consultations. So privately it's covered under extras with private health insurance, but you can actually also get Medicare funding under an enhanced primary care program, or certainly we're very much expanding the public services. So there are pelvic health physios now in the vast majority of public hospitals, particularly the hospitals that specialise in women's issues. So it's definitely growing, and I would really encourage people to seek that support, involve a pelvic health physio as part of your team. And that pelvic health physio should very much also communicate with the other members of the team. It's another one of my little pet things, is that when we're all working a bit geographically separate, it's really important that we're, with permission of the people that we support, that we'll either share written communication, or sometimes it's nice just to jump on the phone and have a bit of a conversation about that patient, and so that we're all on the same page, we're all singing from the same songbook, and the poor patient isn't having to retell their story every time to a whole heap of different people.
So with this type of client population, who commonly is part of their multidisciplinary team, if you can give some general examples?
Certainly. So usually a gynecologist, and sometimes if there are specific vulval issues, some of my patients will see like a vulval dermatologist, then sometimes a urologist, if there's been bladder issues or bladder pain or dysfunctions in that way, gastroenterologist, very much supporting them around management of the IBS and other things. I also work closely, if the pain's been quite persistent, with pain physicians, and so they're often part, and pretty much very often a psychologist or a range of sexual therapists, psychotherapists, relationship therapists, or neuropsychologists, and then sometimes other allied health professionals like a dietitian, sometimes an exercise physiologist, OT, speech for some of them. So it's that can feel a little bit daunting, but I see that sometimes I'll talk to my patients about them, their healthcare team being a little bit like an orchestra, and not every section of the orchestra is always playing. Like sometimes it might just be the strings or just the woodwind, and so it's not like they have to be seeing all of those people all of the time. And it's a matter of just finding that team that feels right for them and that they can trust, and that they're all on the same page with the same piece of music, and that they will see them at different times depending on where they're at, because obviously it can be a financial consideration, a time consideration, a level of exhaustion consideration. Can they get the flexibility from their work or their commitments to be able to, engage with those health professionals, which is why I have a big focus too on self-management and really trying to promote. It's important to engage with those health professionals, but then really building their skills in managing their health.
Yeah, I think it's super helpful to hear, a general list, even to know what the possibilities are, that the GP might recommend, or allied health or health professional might recommend. Like, I didn't even know there were vulval dermatologists. You don't know what you don't know until someone says what the possibilities are. So I think that's super helpful. And I think too, you know, sometimes when you are managing neurodivergence, chronic health conditions, persistent pain, you often will have a team behind you, and that can take a lot of executive functioning actually as well to manage all of the appointments and remembering them and, you know, keeping on top of all the different treatments and things like that that you're engaged in. So that can be a bit of a barrier for people as well. But no, I think that's just super helpful to know who's part of that multidisciplinary team. Thank you.
Yeah, pleasure. And I agree with you around that being a barrier. And I think it's really important for all of us to really be aware of the fact that our patients might have been being asked to do lots of different things from different people, and that we need to be very mindful of that. And often I'll ask them, and I'll put that on my plan, that you're doing something for someone else or whatever. So let's just pick one thing. I'm not going to give you 10 exercises and 2 relaxation practices and a whole heap of other stuff. Let's just focus on what do we feel like is the most important, most impactful thing that you could do from either a movement perspective or, yeah, so I think that's really important.
So, Shan, thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate you coming on the podcast to chat with us. For those interested, we will link Shan's email address and her website in the show notes so you can find out a little bit more about what she does there. But, yeah, thanks so much for coming on. It's been awesome to talk about this with you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. I've had a great time talking about my passion and interest. And I love
that.
Interacting with fellow passionate professionals who are making a difference in their world and just, you know, changing women's lives. It's fantastic.
Yay. Thank you so much. I mean, this is why we do what we do, because we're so passionate about it. And yeah, helping others, helping women in AFAB. It's amazing.
Yeah, it is.
So thank you.
Pleasure.
If you enjoyed this episode and want to support us further, you can do so by subscribing to our Patreon. To become part of our Patreon community, you can buy us a coffee for $5 per month or a wine for $10 per month.
All of our Patreon subscribers receive access to a backlog of exclusive content, to basic text transcripts from season 4 onwards, and to a monthly live Zoom hangout with us and our Patreon community. Our Zoom hangouts are a place to ask questions, chat about your experiences, and connect with other neurodivergent women.
Patreons shouting us to a monthly wine get all that, plus one exclusive content post per month. We really appreciate your support as we aim to make quality mental health information accessible to everyone.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Neurodivergent Woman podcast.
If you have a question or would like to contact us, you can do so through our Facebook and Instagram at the handle The Neurodivergent Woman Podcast or our website ndwomanpod.com. You can also email us directly at ndwomanpod@gmail.com. Bye for now.